Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello, I'm Matt Hansen.
And I'm Tristan Riddell.
And you're listening to the Nerd Party, Shaken Not Stirred Edition.
Talk nerdy to me.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
All right, as you heard my partner and friend say, this is the Nerd Party, episode 31, and we got some really great stuff that we're going to talk about. We're going to, our main focus, our main topic is our top two Bond films from each Bond. Now, this is in celebration and anticipation of Spectre that's coming out next month, but before we get into that, this was released just a couple of weeks ago, and we had to take a week off from our normal schedule, and we didn't really have a chance to talk about this. And, you know, there's a lot of DC news coming out, there's a lot of Marvel news coming out, but this one is probably, I think, some of the most anticipated news, and that is how the teams are going to be divided with Civil War.
Yeah, it's certainly my number one most anticipated movie of next year, so I'm excited to talk about it.
I'm excited too, and I can't say I'm as excited as you because you are the Marvel fan, but I am all, after Winter Soldier, I am all about a Captain America movie.
And listeners have heard me over the last year saying how much I was excited for Age of Ultron. I would say my excitement level for Civil War is probably double what it was for Age of Ultron, and it has been ever since I saw Winter Soldier.
Now, let's just get right down to it. Let's start up. For those of you who don't know, and for those of you who do, it's cool. Everybody needs a refresher. So for those of you who might not know, I'm surprised if you don't know, but Civil War is all about, Captain America versus Iron Man. You know, Steve Rogers versus Tony Stark. It's kind of a battle of ethics, a battle of morals. In the comic books, it's based on superhero registration, you know, and unmasking. It's all about like revealing what your true identities are to the government and becoming government employees.
Right, and we've already learned from Kevin Feige because as fans of the MCU know that there really isn't too much of secret identities, at least in this iteration of the universe, except for maybe Spider-Man at this point. But again, we don't know how he's going to play into Civil War yet. But
exactly.
But because there's no secret identities, Kevin Feige has already said it's less about registration and coming forward with who you really are, as opposed to who do the Avengers and superheroes have to report to? Who should they be under the control of? Should they be their own independent entity, or should they be under government control? Which I think is a really interesting conflict.
Absolutely, and we got a taste of that in Winter Soldier. We established Steve Rogers' aversion to government control because he doesn't want to be an assassin. He wants to be a hero.
What's really interesting now is we've gotten the downsides of both sides, right? Because we saw how operating under government control can go horribly wrong in Winter Soldier because it was corrupt. It was S.H.I.E.L.D. was Hydra. But then, since then, Age of Ultron, now we see what happens when the superheroes are given free reign.
Yeah, yeah. And so they're trying to balance it out. They're trying not to be like – they're trying really hard – not to just make it clear cut and dry where there's got to be some gray. It's not just Team Rogers or Team Stark. It's got to be, I mean, there should be accountability, but at the same time, they shouldn't just be assassins. And where is the line?
Right. And I'm willing to bet just because these movies are so interconnected, and I think they've done a great job storytelling wise of keeping them interconnected, that a lot of people in Washington, because I guess this is going to be like America-based, but it might be UN-based, who knows. But there's going to be a lot of people who are very unhappy that Tony Stark created a killer robot and a small Eastern European country is now destroyed.
Yeah, see, that's the thing, is that like Tony is the entire reason why Ultron exists and why this mayhem happened, and he's not even a metahuman. He just has really cool toys.
Yeah, but he has really cool toys and had free reign to do whatever he wanted. There was no oversight with him.
Yeah, and we even got a little bit of that in Iron Man 2, even though that was a horrible movie. You know, like, we open up with, you got to hand over the suit. He's like, no, I have ownership over the suit. You can't do anything about it legally. And so I'm sure that they're going to feed off of that and go like, well, we couldn't, but now we can.
So I wonder how, I'm guessing it's going to have to do with him feeling responsibility about the Ultron incident. Yeah. But something's going to happen where he becomes pro government control over the Avengers, and Cap, who has already been established who Winter Soldier is, not going to be very trusting of any sort of governmental oversight.
And that's how it was in the comic books. Like, I would be very surprised and probably a little pissed off, like the most of the community, if they flip-flop those.
They're not.
But
I know
that they're not, but it's been established, and so I'm glad that they're following that pattern. Like, I'm not one of those crazy guys, like, you got to follow the comic books to a T, but that is a baseline thing that they should maintain, and I'm glad that they are. So here are the teams as it follows. I'll handle Tony's team. So we have Iron Man, you know, a.k.a. Tony Stark. We got War Machine, of course, because War Machine's just going to go where Iron Man goes. Vision, so he stays with Tony Hawk. That's a Tony Hawk. I knew I was going to do that. So he stays with Tony Stark. That's no real big surprise, seeing how, you know, he kind of was Jarvis, but not really, you know. And then we have the introduction of Black Panther, and that's going to be a lot of fun. And so he's going to be on Tony's team. And then we round it out with Black Widow.
Which surprises me. I want to see how that one plays out more than any of them, because I thought that Romanoff and Rogers had a thing going, or at least a camaraderie going, in Winter Soldier. So I want to know what makes her go against Captain America, or if she's indeed going against Captain America. Maybe she's a double agent. Maybe she's going with Team Iron Man and is reporting back to Team Cap about what they're planning.
There is precedence of that. I mean, there is precedence.
She's
of that
a spy.
In the comic books. Yeah, I mean, she's a spy. And also in the comic books, there were plenty of double agents. There was a lot of people who went back and forth between teams. And, like, even members of the X-Men went back and forth between teams. And so something has got to happen, because I was for sure thought that Hawkeye was going to go with Tony and Black Widow was going to go with Rogers. And
because same here.
Obviously, they cannot be on the same team.
Right.
They're too close. Like, we have to have some sort of drama. We have to have some sort of division, you know? But I thought it was going to be flip-flop.
I thought it was going to be flip-flop, too, but especially with, I would think, with all the Hawkeye stuff they did with Age of Ultron, introducing his secret family, wanted to keep them off the record. I thought he would be pro-government, because government could help them stay anonymous.
Or maybe the reverse of that thing.
Well, maybe that's why, because
yeah.
For Team Cap, we have Hawkeye, Ant-Man, Falcon, Winter Soldier, which will be interesting. And someone who I did not recognize in the promo art, because she's wearing something very similar to what Scarlet Witch was wearing at the end of Age of Ultron, except it was red and not black in this picture. But it's actually Sharon Carter, who was in Winter Soldier briefly.
Briefly, yeah. And apparently is Peggy's descendant.
Yes. Niece, I'm pretty sure.
Niece. And in this promo art, we see Bucky, and he's much more cleaned up. Obviously, he still has the metal arm. But he's not as gruff, not as grimy, not as evil looking.
No,
much more dashing instead of roguish.
Yes, very much so. So, and I can't spoil this because I don't want to spoil you on this. But there was a one of the post credit scenes of Ant-Man actually kind of teases how Bucky will be on Team Cap.
Oh, okay. Well, I kind of want to know that now, and I haven't seen Ant-Man yet, and.
It was actually a really cool scene that everyone was really happy to see.
Ah, damn. Okay, I'll wait. Don't tell me. Like, I figured, I heard some rumor that Bucky was going to be in there, and I was about to ask a question. I was like, I'm wondering how, like, are we going to skip that in Civil War? Like, I was wondering.
There's a post-credit scene in Ant-Man that supposedly, from what I understood, is going to be in Civil War, that scene. It's, like, cut from Civil War.
Oh, okay. Okay, so that scene's going to be in Civil War, and that totally explains, you know, like, how he's going to become a part.
Well, it teases how he's become a part. It's to not give too much away, I have a feeling that the scene that they show was when Cap and Bucky reunite again after the events of the Winter Soldier.
Okay. Now that we have the teams kind of listed out, my first reaction, my gut reaction was, holy crap, Cap has his workout, you know, cut out for him. And you seem to disagree with me on this one.
I didn't necessarily disagree, but what I will say is that I know a lot of people had that reaction. And they're like, why are they giving so much, you know, of the good people to Iron Man's team? And I think it's because, you know, this is Captain America's movie, and we need to feel like Cap and his team are in danger. Because if they are so clearly, if they so clearly outmatch Iron Man's team, then what kind of conflict are we going to have here? Cap needs to be the underdog. And, you know, in all of his movies, he's been the underdog, especially Winter Soldier when he's a renegade. So I think he operates best as a renegade, operates best as an underdog. So I think that's why they're keeping him fairly grounded in terms of his team. But second of all, there was there's one huge glaring omission from both team pictures. And it's one that struck me because I heard that this person was going to be on Team Cap. And I still think this person will be on Team Cap. And the glaring omission from these two pictures is Elizabeth Olsen as Scarlet Witch.
Yeah, she was in an interview recently where, you know, somebody asked her, you know, what team are you on? Are you going to be on? What's the deal? And she didn't give very much information away. But what the key phrase that she used was Scarlet Witch is going to be the wild card of Civil War.
Which actually makes sense because she's the newest member of the team. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't, I would imagine, even though she's fought with the team in Age of Ultron, she still doesn't know where she stands with the team. Because for a long time, she hated the Avengers.
Specifically, Tony Stark.
Which also makes me think, you know, at the end of the day, she may be the wild card, but I don't see her, even after Age of Ultron, having all that much love for Tony. I mean, I can't imagine why she would ally herself with Tony, especially considering that she knows Tony created Ultron. And spoiler alert, if you guys haven't seen Age of Ultron, Ultron's the one that ends up killing her brother. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't see too many scenarios where Scarlet Witch doesn't end up at some point fighting alongside Captain America. And in my opinion, I know they have Vision and I know they have Black Panther, but if you saw what Scarlet Witch could do, that kind of raises Cap's stock price, if you will, if she's on his team.
Yeah, definitely, because he needs some sort of metahuman besides himself, because all of his team members, except for Ant-Man. Well, I mean, Ant-Man's not even, it's all about the suit. You know, like he's the only one that has like super strength. But the thing is, like, yeah, with Tony's team, you have Iron Man and War Machine, which their mech suits are just fan-freaking-tastic. But then you have Black Panther. I don't know too much about him. But then you have the Vision, who is basically godlike.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, like, is Thor going to be discussed? Or are they? They should at least mention him saying, like, oh, he can't be involved with these kind of matters or something like
that. Well, they already sent him on his way. Like, he said he had to go back to Asgard at the end of Age of Ultron and sort things out. So he's busy.
Yeah.
But, no, the fight I really want to see, if this is indeed the case and Scarlet Witch ends up on Team Cap, it would be interesting to see, because the only ones that she would be, the one that you would put her up against is Vision. See what her versus Vision could do.
I would love to see that. Absolutely. And of course, the ultimate battle, Cap versus Tony.
And what I'm really, really kind of curious about is, one of the cool things about the Team Cap picture is, you can't see Ant-Man unless you're really looking, but he's perched on Hawkeye's shoulder. Now, there's a very famous bit from comics, and it was in the Earth's Mightiest Heroes TV cartoon where Hawkeye shoots an arrow with Ant-Man on it, shrunk. And that's, you know, it's one of their battle maneuvers. I really hope that's in this movie.
They have to put that in there. They absolutely 100% have to put that in Civil War. Otherwise, they are doing a huge disservice to the fans and themselves.
But we'll see what happens, but I'm really excited. And again, I don't know the extent of his role. I assume it's not going to be very big. I don't know the extent of his role, but Spider-Man's coming in here somewhere.
Yeah, see, that's the thing is, like, yeah, we're missing, like, Thor's off, you know, helping Asgard. Scarlet Witch is known to be in it, but yet she's not on a team, so that's a mystery.
Hulk's in self-exile.
And then we have Spider-Man. So, and we know Spider-Man's going to be in it, but we don't know, like, is he going to fight? Is it going to be a cameo? Which side is he going to fight for? Is he going to go back and forth, like, potentially Scarlet Witch could be doing? I don't know. We just don't know.
Which, you know, we're a little less than a year from from the release of the movie, but I'm glad that they're holding stuff like that back. Like, I'm totally fine with that. I mean, with the Age of Ultron marketing, they held Vision back until the very last minute, which mm-hmm. I thought was smart, because there was such a fever pitch to see him by the end that when they finally released him, it was good.
Yeah, so, and we need to do the same thing with Spider-Man, because we do not need, like, everyone, nerds, listen, we do not need to know every single fact about every single production before it's even done.
No, because then it's no fun. I kind of, like, part of it, I mean, I like building up the anticipation to the release, because, you know, like I said, I'm so excited for this film. This is probably my number one most anticipated film next year. But part of me does miss the days before the internet, where you could just kind of know nothing about a film and then go to see it and enjoy yourself.
And do you remember the surprise that you would feel? Like, you would be in a theater, and you would be sitting down watching, you know, whatever film, like Jurassic Park, and then all of a sudden you'd see a trailer for another movie, and you'd be like, holy crap, they're coming out with such and such? Oh man, I had no idea. That's going to be so amazing. That doesn't exist now.
No, it can't.
Now we have a teaser to the teaser to the trailer, and we know about that teaser to the teaser to the trailer 30 days before, because all the fans are like, "What? Haven't they come out with that teaser to the teaser to the trailer? They just finished production 3 days ago. Where's our trailer?"
Right. Or, you know, whenever there's this Comic-Con footage, like, the demand for a leak is so high. And I don't understand. I mean, I kind of get it that you want to see the footage that's been released, but I would much rather wait for the high-quality studio-approved release than to watch a cam rip.
Absolutely. I cannot stand cam rips, and the only one that I really succumbed to, out of all the leaks, I was able to hesitate. Even with Age of Ultron, I waited on the leak until a higher-quality one came about. But Suicide Squad, I watched a cam of. I was like, can't wait, gotta see it.
Yeah, I fell susceptible to the Age of Ultron one, just because that's when I was like, I just have to see it, because that one was leaked a week before it was supposed to come out anyway. So I was like, I'll see it, I'll get my fix, and then I'll watch the HQ version.
Right. And then, like, the next day,
not even the next day, 2 hours later, they were like...
It was two hours later,
they put out that damn it Hydra tweet, and then they just said, the hell with it, here's the trailer.
Yeah, I totally thought that was just a marketing stunt, but then they actually pursued legal action to find out who leaked it.
It was a leak.
Yeah.
But what I liked about them, instead of doing the thing where you complain about it, like some other movies did this summer, like, they're just like, you know what, screw it. You guys win. Here's the trailer early. Have fun.
Yeah. Now, okay, here's one thing that I want to talk about, though. And this is more about fan reaction than it is the movie itself with Civil War. So, you know, like, when we found out, like, oh, Cap 3 isn't just going to be your run-of-the-mill Captain America sequel. It's going to be the Civil War storyline. It's going to have Iron Man in it. People are like, oh, cool, Iron Man's going to be in it. Hopefully it's still a Cap movie and not an Iron Man movie. But then all of a sudden they started announcing all, like, Hawkeye, Ant-Man, Falcon, Bucky, Black Panther, Vision, Black Widow, War Machine, all of these people are going to be in it. It got kind of a backlash where people are like, oh, so this is just Avengers 3 then. It's not really a Captain America movie. It's just Avengers 3. Here's the thing. What the hell does it matter? What rules do you think they have to live by, that they have to make their movies to? They could call it whatever they want, and they can do whatever they want and throw in as many people as they want.
Well, not only that, this movie is called Civil War. It's not Civil Skirmish. It's not Cap versus Iron Man. It's called Civil War. You need lots of players for a war. How do you have a movie called Civil War where it's about supposed to be unrest between superheroes, and the only ones that show up to play are Captain America and Iron Man?
Right.
Doesn't make sense. So you if they didn't show up, here's the other thing. Because, you know, if they didn't show up, everyone would be complaining. Well, why can't we see how anyone else is dealing with this war?
That is exactly how it would go down. We even got that with Iron Man 3. Like, ever since we got Avengers, the first one, released, every single Marvel movie after that, people always, like, some mouth breather, you know, like, goes on Twitter and says, why didn't Iron Man just call on his other Avengers pals? This was stupid.
Right, so...
You cannot have the Avengers in every single movie.
No, you can't, but in a movie like this, you have to have them. It wouldn't make any sense to not have them. And the only ones that are going to be absent are the people that they've given excuses to be absent for. Thor, Hulk, you know, other Marvel yeah. movie, other Marvel characters that we can't use because Disney doesn't own the property.
Yeah, and it makes sense. This makes sense. So there are no, like, it doesn't, like, just because they've established phase two and phase, like, phase one and phase two, and they're like, okay, solo movie, solo movie, solo movie, group movie, solo movie, solo movie, solo movie, group movie. Just because they've established that doesn't mean that they have to live by it for every single movie. So just be thankful for what we're getting and stop complaining.
And there were multiple people in Winter Soldier too, granted much less than the ones we're getting here, but that was like a mini team up movie if you wanted one. So I'm excited for it. I think it'll be fine. And from what I understand from, because there's been Civil War footage shown at a couple of conventions thus far. Nothing official release yet, just kind of preview footage. From what I understand, yes, people are in this movie, but it is, people are telling me just from the trailer alone that you get it's still a Captain America movie. So I trust that they haven't lost sight of that.
I'm happy to, and I think the Russo brothers, I think they love Cap and they know what they're doing. So I'm not worried at all. I'm really not.
Not only that, it's the Russo brothers. It's the same writers from, I know you didn't like First Avenger, but it's the same writers from First Avenger and Winter Soldier. They wrote both. The same composer from Winter Soldier, the same cinematographer. Basically, the whole Winter Soldier creative and behind the scenes team is doing this movie.
That's
cool. So, last time turned out really well. I trust this will turn out really well. And if this does turn out really well, then we can be comforted knowing that it's the Russos and this writing team and all these people are going to be doing Infinity War.
Yeah, knowing that that crew, that team is going to be taking over and kind of moving forward is, I think that's, because that is just as important, if not more so, than the people in front of the camera.
Aside from, you know, complaints about Age of Ultron aside, it can't be understated how much Joss Whedon brought to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And now that he's gone, I think that this is a very competent team to replace him. Or at least, you know, give us the next iteration.
Absolutely. In the fandom, people are going to, people divide themselves. It's human nature. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, like, it's always team such and such and team such and such in almost every single kind of fandom. Whenever there's a love triangle, there's team blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Or whenever there's one faction against another, you always take sides. So, right now, you know, you are a huge Cap fan, and mm-hmm. this is going to be a Cap movie. Would you say that you're already Team Captain America?
I think I have to be Team Captain America for the Civil War.
I would be surprised if you weren't.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just prerequisite that, you know, I'm just Team Cap anything. Like the day that they retire Steve Rogers from the cinematic universe is probably the point where I'll stop caring about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, if that's even possible. But and I'm sure they're gonna movie. Well, actually, I don't know, because I think that you can make an even more interesting movie if you can see both sides, or you see a point to both sides. So.
Yeah.
I was going to say I think the movie will lead you to Team Cap, but maybe not. Maybe people will have different ideas.
I hope so. I mean, that'll be a sign of a good movie if you can not saying that Tony's the villain, but if you can sympathize with the villain or the antagonist and you can understand their motivations and see where they're coming from, that is a much more intriguing movie than just having a villain who twirls his mustache.
Agreed.
Now, with me, I don't know. I mean, I am such an Iron Man fan. Like, I love just the idea of Iron Man. I love Tony Stark. I love how snarky he is and how brash he is. And I love Black Widow. The Vision, I think, is really awesome. War Machine, I can take or leave him. It doesn't really matter. I don't know much about Black Panther, but I'm really intrigued on what he can bring to the table. And I don't really like the people on Cap's team.
I love the people on Cap's team. That's the other thing. And especially if I was thinking about this the other day too, and the more I've been rewatching Age of Ultron, the more and more I've been like falling in complete love with Scarlet Witch, to the point where Captain America is my favorite superhero, but if I were a hero in the MCU, I want Scarlet Witch's powers terribly.
Yeah, but the thing is, we don't know if Scarlet Witch is on Cap's team, because we have Bucky, we have Falcon, we have Carter, and we have Hawkeye and Ant-Man. I haven't seen Ant-Man yet. I don't give a crap about Hawkeye. Falcon, I can take or leave him, and Bucky, I don't know what the obsession is, but see, that's the thing, is like, I'm so neutral on Cap's team, but I love Cap so much, so terribly much, and in the comic books, I was rooting for Captain America, but in the films, I feel like, I don't know.
You're going to end up on Team Cap.
I probably will be.
Wait till you see a trailer. Maybe that'll entice you more. I don't know.
I like the idea of non-registration. I like the idea of not working for the government because it's, you know, whether it's the American in me or not, I like the idea of fighting for independence, you know, like even though it's about the American government, I like the idea of you can't tell us what to do and you can't, you know, and everything like that.
Plus, I think especially with Age of Ultron, now I loved the movie and I love Iron Man still and I love Tony Stark, but you watch that movie and some of his beliefs and ideas are really starting to get misguided, or at least they're showing it that way. I mean, he's kind of losing his mind a little bit. But maybe that's just my opinion.
Yeah, I think you're right. I'm probably, even though I'm not even though I like more team members on Tony's team and I like Tony, I think I'll probably end up just being Team Cap. Probably. All right. Well, let's move on. Okay. So, topic: James Bond, Spectre next month.
A month and a half away. It actually feels real now.
I know, right? I'm super stoked, super excited.
I'm ready.
And what we're going to do is we're going to go through each Bond, starting with Sean Connery and ending with Daniel Craig, omitting George Lazenby, because who gives a crap?
A lot of people do, but people shouldn't.
And also, this is our top two, and you can't really give a top two of George
Lazenby. No, you really can't. And aside from the ending and the Bond girl, I don't get the obsession with that movie among the Bond circles. I really don't. I tried watching it the other day. It's slow and it's boring. And I'll say this much, if you don't like the Bond that's in the movie, you're not going to like the movie.
Yeah, I everything that you just said, I completely agree. So, all right. So let's just start at the top. Let's start with Sean Connery. This one might be easier than some of the other ones, but what are your top two, number one and number two?
See, you say that, but having rewatched his Bond films recently, because I have that big, nice Blu-ray set with all the films in it, Connery, by far, I think, is still my favorite Bond, even with Daniel Craig, who I really like. There's something about Connery that no matter what you think of him in real life or no matter, you know, what other crappy movies he's been in, he's got this magnetic charm from the first time that you see him at the poker table in Dr. No. And so we were having this conversation by text earlier. I know you can come up with a couple that you don't like, but you're wrong about them. But there is not a Connery movie that I dislike. That even includes Diamonds Are Forever, which I know is a silly movie, but is a total guilty pleasure. I will watch that over Honor Majesty's Secret Service any day of the week.
I like Diamonds Are Forever. I liked it as a kid. I like it as an adult because of the nostalgia when I was a kid. I didn't really get the hate. I just thought it was a cheesy Bond movie, you know? Like, I didn't really have dislike for it. So I'm with you, man.
No, there are people who think it's the worst one.
I
don't get that either. But, God, if you had to put a gun to my head and say, give me your top two Connery films. I was telling you this the other day. Rewatching Goldfinger, which I think is probably most people's favorite Connery Bond film. Mm-hmm. The pacing of that film, even though it was made in 1964, it has the pacing of a modern movie. Sure, it has, you know, 60s effects and 60s sensibilities, and maybe the fact that he pretty much forces himself on pussy galore wouldn't play too well today in today's overly PC culture. Aside from that, though, it plays very much like a movie from today. I'm surprised how fast-paced it is, because when I love watching older movies, but I go into older movies realizing that they had a different pace, they had a different sense of storytelling, they had different sensibilities, and this one really still feels modern. It's surprising how well, for a movie that's 51 years old at this point, how well that one still plays. So I guess that would be my favorite one. For number two, though, I really like From Russia with Love. I think Dr. No is a brilliant introduction. Thunderball, to me, is the weakest, but that's just because I feel like the underwater cinematography, while great, takes up a lot of the movie, and for a lot of the climax, I don't know who's who. This one gets a lot of hate, but I think I'm going to go with it as my number two because I consider it the most fun, or at least one of my most fun ones. I'm going to put You Only Live Twice as number two. And people crap on that one because it doesn't reach the heights of Goldfinger, and people are saying that Connery by that point looks like he's grown tired of the role. I mean, I kind of see that to an extent, but I think it speaks volumes when a bored Connery is better than, you know, a presumably enthusiastic Lazenby. But there's just something about You Only Live Twice that I love. And I like the Japanese locale. Like, I really like the Bond girls in it. Or at least the first one, anyway, that gets poisoned. I gotta get, you know, I also choose this one because it has Donald Pleasance as Blofeld. And this is the first time you actually get to see Blofeld. And Donald Pleasance is someone I love just because he's in practically every Halloween movie until he died. But he's a great villain. I love the whole idea of a volcano base. I mean, Austin Powers has ripped off probably that movie more than anyone else's, because you got the... I love the scene with Blofeld has his bridge that he can press his foot down and he dumps the person into the piranha pool.
Right, yeah.
But it's very 60s, it's very campy, but I really love that movie. That's one of my favorite rewatches of all the Bond films. So I'll go Goldfinger number one and You Only Live Twice number two.
Well, those are my exact same choices. Goldfinger number one, You Only Live Twice number two. I love those movies, and I see nothing wrong with You Only Live Twice. I absolutely 100% love it. No BS, no nothing. I don't care if you think it's cheesy, because today, yeah, it's cheesy, but back then, it was, you know, it wasn't as cheesy. You know, it some of this stuff that we think is cliche was not cliche back then. And the whole volcano base, that's just cool. You know, like, he has a base inside of a volcano. And the space stuff, the outer space stuff that they did in You Only Live Twice, is what they achieved successfully is what Moonraker failed at.
Oh, yeah.
You see what I'm saying? Like Bond should never be in space, and we almost got him in space, but then at the last second they pulled him out. But this deals with space terrorism, you know, and space hijacking and everything like that.
Yeah, you talk about cool things. Blofeld has a rocket ship that can eat other rocket ships.
Yes, he has rocket ships that, like, literally envelop another rocket ship that's smaller. That's just cool. And, like, the entire world's like, what's going on? We're shooting stuff into space and somebody's stealing it. That is cool.
It's those damn... The U.S. says it's those damn Soviets. The Soviets say it's those damn Americans. And it's really...
Damn Ruskies. Yeah, yeah. And it's Spectre all along. And that's just cool. That is... And James Bond deals with it on the ground. Yeah, like, we have larger-than-life situations, and he deals with it on the ground. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's... Call it racist if you want. You know, like they have that scene where they try to make him into an Asian person. Yeah, like, when I was younger, I didn't really think it was racist at the time. I didn't think it was yellow face. I was just like, okay, that's random. We're going to make, like, a 6'4" Scotsman look like an Asian man.
That, you know, that goes into that, you know, pussy galore territory where it's like, okay, that didn't date very well.
Yeah, it's just like, you couldn't get away with that today, but we'll let that slide because it's the 60s. But yeah, I love it. And also with Goldfinger, you know, we talk about Goldfinger a lot. What can be said that hasn't been said already? It's the standard. It's Sean Connery in his prime. It's James Bond in his prime. And it's just the best. Goldfinger's the best.
You know what scene really works in Goldfinger to this day? It's a great scene of tension, is the Bond almost gets himself split in two by the laser.
Oh yeah! Oh yes, yes, and that is parodied, and sometimes not even parodied, but homage.
Oh yeah, because that's where, you know, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. Yeah. But that's parodied. But like the tension and the music that goes along with that scene, that scene still works.
It's just everything about it—the pacing, the action, the writing, the direction—all of it. Like if you did a shot for shot remake today, you would not be able to tell the difference. It would not feel like a 60s movie.
And actually, I think the reason I take that scene so much is because even though I loved From Russia with Love and Dr. No, that scene with the laser is the first time you see Connery as Bond get nervous.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he enjoys his manhood. He does not want to see it split in half by a laser. So, all right, moving on. We probably should pick up the pace a little bit.
No, we don't need to.
Roger Moore. I want to be honest with you. Right off the bat,
you're gonna say what I'm probably gonna echo.
I don't like Roger Moore. I don't like him in the least. There is not a single Roger Moore movie where I go, you know what? I really like that film. That's one of my favorite Bond films.
I disagree.
Not
with,
at all.
I disagree with that part. But I
well,
will.
This is no. This is just personally.
No. But like, I echo most of what you said. You know, if we're gonna count Lazenby, then Roger Moore is my second least favorite Bond.
Same here. And the thing with Roger, like this was hard for me to pick these movies, and I'll go first this time.
It wasn't hard for me at all to pick these movies.
Well, see, it was hard for me because I watched them as a kid, and I was bored to tears when I was a child
I can give Roger Moore, there are two that I absolutely love.
They bored me to tears when I was a child, and so I actively avoided them as an adult. And so I really don't know them that well. Like, I need to force myself, like, and this feels like the scene in Clockwork Orange where, like, he opens up his eyelids.
They're not all that bad.
But that, I feel like that's what I keep feeling like when I want to sit down, like, I should sit down and have a Roger Moore marathon. And I just, like, I can't do it because I don't want to force myself to. But the movies that I picked, and I'm sure you're going to make fun of me for this, and my reasoning behind it is not because I think these are the best Roger Moore films, but these are just the ones that I remember kind of giggling at as a child. My top two are A View to a Kill and Octopussy.
You complained this whole time about how Roger Moore is your least favorite Bond, and then you pick two of the worst in his filmography as your favorite.
Yes, and here's the reason why. Like, I almost picked Moonraker because it's so ridiculous. Like, these movies are so ridiculous.
I would have lost all respect for you had you picked Moonraker.
But that's the thing, is that I, like, if I want to watch Moonraker, I will watch Moonraker and enjoy it because it is a piece of garbage. Like, watching Moonraker is the same way that I watch Twilight, because I just throw jelly beans at the screen the entire time going, "Poo!" This, like, it's so amazing, it's horribleness. And that's what Moonraker is. Like, it doesn't feel, Moonraker's not a Bond film.
It's a Star Wars film in Bond clothing.
Yeah, exactly. And so with A View to a Kill, it's just, you have the San Francisco backdrop. It's got Christopher Walken as a bad guy.
Yeah, but you also have Roger Moore looking 100 years old.
Yeah, I don't really care how old James Bond looks. If we had a James Bond movie where he was 65, I wouldn't care.
Considering all the stuff that he does in View to a Kill, you don't care that he looks 100 years old?
I really don't.
He's got Shatner syndrome. He's got Star Trek V Shatner syndrome.
If that bothers you, it bothers you. It just doesn't bother me. But, like, it's just, I love the absurdity of the Silicon Valley, you know, aspect, and Christopher Walken, Grace Jones, they fight on the Golden Gate Bridge. I just love how over the top it is. And so for that, it makes it entertaining. And Octopussy, I like Octopussy, and I love how ridiculous how Bond infiltrates the circus. We see Bond as a clown. It's absurd. It's
not
crazy.
Only do we
That's
get Bond
why.
As a clown, we get Bond doing a Tarzan yell. It's View to a Kill is at least entertaining. Octopussy is trash.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the only way that I can justify watching Roger Moore movies, because they're such trash that it's that when you go on Netflix and you try to watch the one-star films, the trashy films, because you find them entertaining because they are trash. And I'm sure there's tons of people out there who are huge Roger Moore fans and who are just cringing at what we're saying about them and yelling at their stereos. But this is just how I personally feel. This is my personal opinion. I do not like him, and so I have to watch his movies ironically.
Well, I think you just need to rewatch some of his movies again in a more forgiving light, because it sounds like you haven't seen them in a long time.
I haven't.
And so I will redeem some of those Roger Moore fans out there, because I'm sure they existed. The man was Bond for 12 years. Longer than anybody. And so while his movies always did have an element of camp, I argue that he had one really, really good one that I absolutely love, and one pretty decent one that I think is a good little flick, although some people might find it boring, but I enjoyed it. So the one that I think is really, like, his best film, like, straight Bond film, is Spy Who Loved Me. I think that coming after... I like Live and Let Die, but that's a blaxploitation film, and so you have to watch it as such. Man with the Golden Gun is terrible. It's hard to decide which one Man with the Golden Gun is worse than Octopussy. Yeah, it's that bad. That's actually my least favorite one, because although I like Christopher Lee, the story is slow, and aside from Maude Adams, who is Octopussy and is in Man with the Golden Gun, she's not the main Bond girl. The main Bond girl they have in Man with the Golden Gun is this Ditz, who's supposed to be an agent that just gets her ass thrown in a trunk and kidnapped and is just, like, really, really stupid. Like, they make her a stupid character. So we get to Spy Who Loved Me, which is the third one. And aside from the story, which I think is really, really good, I think the main reason I took to Spy Who Loved Me most because usually when I watch these movies, I watch them all back to back to back in the order in which they were released. And coming after Man with the Golden Gun, to see not only a stronger female character who's a Bond girl in the 70s, but for the first time you can see the social progression, because this is the first time that I really feel like they've shown a Bond girl who is pretty much an equal to James Bond. Now, she still gets in trouble and she still has Bond to rescue her, but throughout the movie you're shown that she's competent at what she does. She's a Soviet agent. She's basically a Soviet female James Bond. Just seeing their pairing and what they go through in that film, I think, is really, really exceptional. I think that it holds up, as far as Roger Moore movies go, that's the one that holds up best. Now, it's still very 70s and very dated, and the soundtrack is very discified. So that part of it doesn't necessarily age well, but the story is actually really good. I would say that's probably my favorite of the Roger Moore Bond films. Second one that I said I think is decent, although some people may find it boring, is For Your Eyes Only. Now, I did Moonraker was just overload for me. Like, I just couldn't take it anymore by the time we got to the end. And, you know, even though I didn't think she was terrible, when you get to if you thought Pussy Galore was bad, when you get to a Bond girl named Holly Goodhead, then then, you know, I think that we're just scraping the bottom of the barrel here. So For Your Eyes Only, I think, was kind of an attempt after Moonraker came out and wasn't necessarily very well received, that to ground, if you will, as much as a Roger Moore Bond movie can be grounded. But it was a little bit more serious. The camp value was reduced a little bit more. The story was pretty good, and I liked the. I think some of the key for me to liking these movies, ironically, are the Bond girls. And you wouldn't think that about me, but the stronger they get, the more I like them. And Melina in this film is the girl, and she's out for revenge for the death of her parents. And very much like Major Amosova from Spy Who Loved Me is a very competent woman who can take care of herself and ends up feeling more like Bond's partner than Bond's damsel. So, you know, while it's not the best movie, I think it's very good. I can watch those two and enjoy myself, especially Spy Who Loved Me.
Solid picks, and you're right. I mean, I need to go back and rewatch them as an adult and give them a better chance, and I will. For those of you who are despising me right now because of my view of Roger Moore, I promise I will give him a fifth shot. All right, so Timothy Dalton. Now this one's a little bit harder, easier, depending on how you look at it, because Timothy Dalton only has two films.
We'll just have to talk about both briefly, I think.
Yeah, because, okay, so my number one, like the one that I like the most, we could at least talk about that, is License to Kill as opposed to Living Daylights.
I like Living Daylights more than License to Kill.
See, this one was kind of hard for me to choose because I like them very equally. Like, I see them as kind of one complete work. You know, like, it's Dalton as Bond, and he only had two, so I see it as, like, part one and part two. And so it's kind of more of a toss-up for me on which one I like more, but with License to Kill, I remember for the longest time, my dad would not let me watch License to Kill. Like, he would only let me watch Living Daylights.
It is, well, up to that point, I would say that that's the darkest of all the Bond films. Now, what's kind of ironic is at the time, obviously, Timothy Dalton didn't get that big of a warm reception. He couldn't have, having only done two films. And I think especially License got a colder reception than Living Daylights. But going back and watching them now, I think it's just a matter of wrong place, wrong time. Because if you watch it now, they're not terribly dissimilar from what Daniel Craig is doing today.
You are absolutely right, because a lot of people don't like Daniel Craig's interpretation. I mean, obviously you and I do. But I think you've made that point before. But this is really spot on, because it's like people are saying, like, oh, you know, like, he's too gruff, he's too violent, and people kept saying, oh, with Casino Royale, he needs to grow into Bond, you know, he needs to become more refined. But then you look at Timothy Dalton, and Timothy Dalton, like, his Bond gets crap done. Like, he will achieve the mission however he sees fit.
Not only that, it's the first Bond, and I think that we've seen it in these Craig ones, but if I'm not mistaken, I really have to think if I'm missing something, but I think it's the first Bond. He was the first Bond to go renegade because License to Kill is all about him being renegade.
Yes. And now it's passé. Like going renegade is the thing to do. Like in the Mission Impossible movies, every single movie except for the second one. So out of the five Mission Impossible movies, only one of them is he not going rogue. One of them is called Rogue Nation, for God's sake.
I know, which I'm going to guess you still haven't seen.
No, I have not.
God. you know, in a couple of weeks, I'll just spoil our itinerary, listeners. In a couple of weeks, we wanted to talk about The Martian when it comes out in theaters, but I don't know. I'm kind of reluctant to agree to it because Kristen won't go see the freaking movie.
No, that one I'll go see.
Okay.
That one I'll go see. It's Ridley Scott.
It's not going to work. This show is not going to work, Tristan, if you don't see the goddamn movie.
No, I know that one I'm totally going to see because that's the kind of movie that's going to take me to the theater. Mission Impossible was not the type of movie that takes me to theaters.
I don't understand that.
I have my own algorithm. Maybe I'll share it with you one day. But Martian is one that'll take me to.
Anyway, but.
Anywho.
But like I said, I think that it was just wrong place, wrong time because, yeah, Daniel Craig has his detractors, but it's much more accepted now than when it was when Dalton was doing it. I think part of it was, too, by the time you have a Bond film like Die Another Day, we're ready for a serious Bond.
Yes. Yes, very much so.
Dalton came at the right place, right time for me in my rewatch because, I'm sick of Camp Moore by that point. And just having the grounded guy in Living Daylights, I think he makes a great impression. The only thing that about Living Daylights that plays awkwardly now is he kind of allies himself with the Mujahideen in that movie. That's back when Afghanistan was our ally, which is ironic now. But other than that, it's a solid little film. And License to Kill, the only thing I have against that film versus Living Daylights is it's a little bit more slower paced than I liked it to be.
Yes.
It doesn't move quite as well. It's still good. The pacing's a little off. I think that it's a little too long for its own good, but that's maybe a minor nitpick. Also, I like the Living Daylight song better than License to Kill. But
I think the thing with me is that I didn't really like the cellist that much in Living Daylights.
She wasn't great, but there were times when the redhead in License to Kill got on my nerves.
I agree, but I think what really saved License to Kill for me is because going rogue was such a new concept and so out of the norm for Bond, like that was just exciting for me. That entire situation. And actually, one thing, like I remember talking to a friend of mine, like as we grew up watching Bond together, he didn't like Timothy Dalton as a Bond. Like he liked the Timothy Dalton movies, but he didn't really like Timothy Dalton as a Bond because he said that he smiled too much.
I don't remember him smiling hardly at all.
I know. I thought that was an interesting takeaway. Like, I was like, really? That's your reasoning for not liking Timothy Dalton?
I think the only one I remember him smiling at was when he's at Felix's wedding at the beginning of License to Kill. That's the only time I can remember him smiling.
No, there. Like, if you go back and watch it now, obviously, if you look for something, you're gonna find it. But in those two movies, he does actually like whenever he cracks a joke. Or like, because here's the thing is like Roger Moore was so deadpan, like he told a joke so much that you never knew when he was telling a joke, because with like Sean Connery, he would give like a little smirk, you know, like whenever he was telling a joke or trying to make light of a situation. Roger Moore just did it deadpan. And so sometimes it would fall flat. Like when Timothy Dalton would say like, scare the living daylights out of it.
Oh, you know, yes,
like
I remember that. Yeah.
Like he was just really impressed with himself whenever he made a pun or a joke. And so he kind of showed it.
Well, it was very Connery. It was very Connery-esque. I would compare Dalton more to Connery than I would to Moore. But,
oh, hardcore. Yes. Yeah.
But jolly would not be a word that I would use to describe his Bond.
Jolly. No. Smiley. Yes.
But quite angry, actually, especially that second film.
But, oh, my gosh. Yeah.
But after License to Kill wasn't so warmly received, they did something that they really hadn't done before and really, you know, hadn't done before ever with the franchise. They put it on hold for 6 years.
6 years. Yeah, that was something new. That was unheard of back then. Like right now we're just kind of like, oh yeah, it's going to take 6 years to get the next Star Trek movie. Oh well, I guess that's how things are done now.
Well, I mean, I see your point, but like they just you know a Bond year had been coming out at least every year or every 2 years at the most, maybe 3 years. Mm-hmm. But it was a long 6 years. But when they finally came back, I think when it comes to Pierce Brosnan, people compare him to Roger Moore, and I kind of get that because his films camped it up a little bit, especially the last two. But unlike Roger Moore, I can't shit too much on Pierce Brosnan because this is the Bond that got me into Bond.
See that here? Yeah, here's the thing: is that I'm glad that you said that in the way that you did, because I was raised on James Bond, probably a little too much and probably a little too early. My dad's a huge James Bond fan, obviously, and we watched those movies together. We watched all the Sean Connors, we watched all the Timothy Daltons, all the Roger Moores, just on loop, just constantly, VHS tape after VHS tape. And so I was 9 when Goldeneye came out, and I went to go see it with my dad. And this was the first time ever, because I was born in 86, and Timothy Dalton's came out in 87 and 89. Obviously, I am way too young to understand that or go to the theater for that, obviously. But with Goldeneye, I was just old enough to kind of go with parental supervision, you know. And still, there was stuff in there I shouldn't have seen. But I remember going and thinking, oh, man, oh, my goodness. Like, this is a Bond movie in my lifetime. Like I said, obviously Dalton was in my lifetime, but this is a Bond that I am experiencing for the first time in my consciousness, my lifetime. This is my Bond. Sean Connery was my dad's Bond when he was a kid. Pierce Brosnan is now my Bond, because your Bond is defined as the one that you experience when you're a kid until you're old enough to have your own choice. Like, whether Pierce Brosnan is my favorite Bond or not is immaterial, but he is my Bond because he's my childhood Bond. And I was absolutely blown away by Goldeneye.
Now, my introduction to Bond is kind of a funny story, because Goldeneye came out in 95. I was 6. So I was still a little too young to even be aware of it. But aside from the fact, too, that in 95, I wasn't even living in the country. I didn't move back to the U.S. until 96. Mm-hmm. But the way I got introduced to Bond was I think it was 97. It was probably right before Tomorrow Never Dies came out. But I think it was 97 when that Nintendo 64 GoldenEye game was released. And I got it Christmas of 90. No, it must have been 96, because I got it that Christmas. But so I played. I love that game. Like, I just, you know, my dad and I would play that game, and you know, I had no idea that that James Bond was a movie character. As far as I knew, he was a game character. And you know, in the middle of playing, when I, you know, my dad was like, you know, this is based on a movie, right? And I'm like, James Bond is a. There's a James Bond movie singular question mark.
Right, singular question mark, yeah.
So I go to the store and I rent GoldenEye. So I got introduced to it through the game, went to the video store, saw that there was a wall of James Bond films, and I was kind of overwhelmed. You know, what? I'm 8 years old at that point. But I rented GoldenEye and I watched GoldenEye, and there I became a Bond fan. But yeah, if we're talking about top two, Pierce Brosnan, I have a feeling that you and I are going to have the same ones. GoldenEye number one, for the obvious reasons. I think it still holds up well today.
Mm-hmm.
Best to this day, unless this changes in Spectre, which I don't know if it will, but it might. But to this day, still has the best Bond femme fatale in Xenia on a top.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Let's just get this out of the way. GoldenEye, Tomorrow Never Dies. Okay. Yeah. Top two Pierce Brosnan films. Those are amazing. I often equate those to, not so much anymore, but I used to say, like, GoldenEye is to Casino Royale what Quantum Solace is to Tomorrow Never Dies.
I think Tomorrow Never Dies I like more than Quantum of Solace, though.
And that's what I'm about to say, is that, like, when Quantum of Solace came out, I was just like, hey, you know, I tried to defend it. Like, I tried to be apologetic towards it, saying, like, it's nowhere near as good as Casino Royale, but it's still a solid movie. Kind of how I feel with Tomorrow Never Dies. But I think Tomorrow Never Dies is light years ahead of Quantum of Solace. So I don't really say to that anymore. But yeah, GoldenEye is, like, pretty much, like, it is a toss-up for me between GoldenEye and Goldfinger. Like, that is how much I love GoldenEye.
It really is that good. like I said, best Bond femme fatale. I love how it just reinvented Bond for the 90s. Like, it was the first time it took on a very modern sensibility. I love, you know, the introduction of Judi Dench as M, who...
Oh, yeah.
I'm still... That still is a wound that really hurts, knowing that she's not going to be in the films anymore.
And that's pretty amazing if you think about it, is that she was introduced as M in 95.
And wait,
95!
And lasted all the way till 2012.
That's amazing. That is amazing.
But because I grew up with, you know, the post-95 Bond films, she's just been M to me. Mm-hmm. So the fact that we have someone else's M now, even though I love Ralph Fiennes, I think he's going to do a fantastic job.
Perfect M.
Part of it just feels like there's something missing. That's nobody's fault, though. They handled her death very well. But, you know, it's still a wound that is still pretty fresh.
Yeah, it needed to happen, but I think it's good.
But so her introduction when she calls him, you know, I think you're a dinosaur, a relic of the Cold War. You know, just bringing that 90s sensibility into Bond. And I just knew I was gonna love her when she says, if I wanted sarcasm, I'll talk to my children. Thank you very much.
And the 90s sensibility with Moneypenny as well.
Yeah, that too.
I mean, no longer is Moneypenny like fawning after him and everything like that. She is a headstrong woman of the 90s and, you know, like totally curtailing his advances. Now, I did not like how they kind of went back on that with... is not enough.
When she's making out with Virtual Bond and Tomorrow Never... I mean, not to Die Another Day.
Die, so freaking stupid. Like, it's just they established a premise and, like, I would have liked to have seen a little bit more cat and mouse on, you know, Bond's end than on Moneypenny's end. And it just... I don't know. That's the only thing that bothered me. But with GoldenEye, I think they did it the right way. Like, they needed this... They did not need another stereotypical 60s... figure secretary that was only there to be the sarcastic sexual eye for Bond. She knew what she was doing. She was good at what she does, and she rebuked his advances, and that's what we needed in the 90s.
She rebuked his advances, but she kind of played along with it too. I mean, those first two films, she's still flirting with him.
Yeah, I mean, flirting is fine, but don't say like, oh, Bond, when are you gonna come over, please? You know, like I'm waiting. I cooked you a dinner. You let the roast go cold. You know, like crap like that. We didn't need that.
Yeah, no, we didn't need that. But you know, that was cool. Yeah, it's just a fantastic movie and a fantastic game. If you guys have never played the N64 Bond game, GoldenEye game, that still holds up today.
I have a 64 in my house just for that game.
But moving on to the one that I think is discussed less, and Tomorrow Never Dies, which a lot of people don't like, and I feel is terribly underrated.
Yeah, I completely agree. I don't understand why people don't like this movie. This is a solid film. This is a great spy film. This is a great satirical piece on how the news influences our way of thinking. Like, granted, this, you know, the media mogul of Elliot Carver.
Is Jonathan Pryce a cartoonish villain? Yes, he absolutely is.
Yeah, exactly. It's a cartoonish villain and it's over the top, but it still makes a statement. That's what I like about it, is that would a media mogul ever do this? No, not in 100 billion years, but the like how much a crazed madman can affect the news just to sell papers and just to increase his earnings. Yeah. Let's see how far this person can go.
Plus, any movie that makes me like Terry Hatcher, that's a movie well done.
Yeah, the only movie that Terry Hatcher's in that I actually enjoyed.
And she's great. I love it when she gets reintroduced and she just goes up and slaps Bond.
And the thing is, like, she sells a prior relationship. You believe that Bond would be attracted to this woman, possibly in love with this woman. It makes sense the way that they played
Although
it.
Although I will say, when I was young and I saw the cover art for Tomorrow Never Dies and she's on there, I did get confused because I couldn't really tell them apart. She kind of has the same hairstyle as Natalia from GoldenEye. Oh. So I thought it was the same person.
Yeah. Like, why is Lois Lane on the Bond poster?
We're talking about like me liking films based on Bond girls. Another underrated aspect of the movie, I think, is Michelle Yeoh as Wai Lin, I think is her name. But she kicks ass. I loved her as the Bond girl in Tomorrow Never Dies.
We had tons of women kick ass in previous Bond films. Tons, tons. But there was something different about how they were handled in the 90s in GoldenEye and Tomorrow Never Dies. There was a little bit more respect. maybe I'm overstating it. Maybe I'm overstating it because, but I just felt like there was so much more respect with Wei Lin than there has been with other Bond girls.
There has been. There absolutely has been. And then the very next movie we had Dr. Christmas Jones.
Right. Christmas Jones. We're not even going to talk about that because our top two is GoldenEye and Tomorrow Never Dies. If you watched Tomorrow Never Dies and you didn't like it and you saw it once and you never rewatched it, go back and rewatch it because it holds up. It's pretty good.
Although I don't recommend subjecting you to this, but go back and watch World That Is Not Enough and Diner of the Day, and then go watch Tomorrow Never Dies and be grateful that
that we had those first two. Yeah, I felt like Brosnan kind of got. I feel like Brosnan was wasted. I think that's the thing.
Half of his movies were good.
Well, that's the thing. Half of his movies were good, but I feel like he was such a good Bond. Like let's talk about that for a second. Like him as a Bond. He's great. He's quintessential. He's a great action hero. He's very suave with the ladies. And, you know, like, he wears a suit really well.
The attitude.
Yeah, he's got the attitude. Everything about him, he looks like Bond. He acts like Bond. He smells like Bond. It's just, I think he was so spot on. Like, probably one of the best casting choices.
Yeah, well, it was obviously meant to be because you do know the story that at the time, He was originally cast for Dalton's films, but had to back out at the last moment because his contract with Remington Steele got extended. So he had to step down from the Dalton films, but then Remington Steele was canceled by the time GoldenEye came around, and he was offered the part again. So it was meant to be. It was one of those things.
And did you hear that Mel Gibson and Liam Neeson passed on the role? How would that have made sense?
I don't know. Liam Neeson maybe could have made sense, but not Mel Gibson.
I don't see either of them working.
In retrospect, it's a good thing it wasn't Mel Gibson. I'll even extend to the fact that Brosnan had 2.5 good films because I think the first hour of Die Another Day is okay. It's actually pretty good. It's when the silliness starts happening with the ice castle that it all goes to shit.
You know what? You're kind of right. I mean, yeah, the only thing I'll say about Die Another Day is James Bond does not get captured and held for, what was it, 13 months? Something like that?
Something ridiculous. Long enough to grow like a shaggy-ass beard and all that stuff.
James Bond does not do that, okay? He's captured for an hour at maximum, okay? He leaves when he's good and ready. James Bond is not a prisoner of war.
That part didn't bother me so much.
That bothered the crap out of me. Like, that I was disgusted with that. That was one of the major things that I was disgusted with that movie, was like, no way in hell does James Bond allow himself to be captured.
Well, that didn't bother me so much. But aside from that, the first half of Die Another Day is not bad. It's not terrible.
No, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like take that out of the equation. I completely agree with you.
Mm-hmm. And then, like I said, once we go to the ice castle and lasers, and thank God Rosamund Pike has redeemed herself.
I was just about to say, I was like, yeah, we get Rosamund Pike in that one. So, okay, so we need to move on. Okay, so last, but definitely not least, Daniel Craig.
And we're really only talking about two movies here, too, because even though I don't hate Quantum of Solace, it's easily the weakest of the three, by far.
That's the thing. Like, anybody who, you know, really has most of their brain cells can tell you that Quantum of Solace is easily the weakest of the three, as you said. Now, I'm sure that we're gonna get some letters saying, like, actually, Tristan and Matt, I think Quantum of Solace is fantastic for these following reasons.
No, and actually, there's actually people out there, I don't understand why, but there are people out there who absolutely think Skyfall is the worst of the three.
I don't get that. I don't get that at all. Now, I want to talk about Skyfall because, now, Casino Royale and Skyfall, obviously the top two. You and I have differing opinions on this one. What your number one, I'm assuming.
I'm giving the edge to Skyfall, but just because we have differing opinions doesn't mean that either of us don't acknowledge that I love Casino Royale.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that. No, I'm just trying to say is that I think Skyfall is great. I think it's fantastic. It's my number two for a reason. I think it's amazing. I think it's one of the best Bond films out there, out of the pantheon of Bond films that have been made. I genuinely believe that. I love it. I watch it all the time. But I think it's overrated.
No.
I do. No. I honestly think it's overrated. I think, like, so many people, Like, even though I just now said it's one of the best Bond films of all time, I watch it all the time, I think it's a great movie, I, like, people talk about this film with this quiet reverence that I think...
That it deserves.
A little, I think it's a little undeserved. I do. I like now realize what we're arguing about here. We're arguing about how much greatness Skyfall and how much praise Skyfall deserves, because you're saying it deserves a 10. I'm saying it deserves a 9.5.
There's a reason I saw Skyfall like 5 times in the theaters, more than any Bond film I've seen before.
Well, okay. So I think the main thing with me is the pacing.
That's not a problem for me at all.
I think Skyfall could have been a lot shorter. I think it could have been a lot shorter.
I think the supporting cast in Skyfall is a lot better, too.
Yeah, I think Skyfall could have been a little bit tighter. I think it should have been a couple more rounds of editing.
Maybe. Although, Casino Royale is pretty long, too.
Casino Royale is long, but it doesn't feel that long to me. Skyfall felt long.
Well, here's the thing. It also is a function of how old I was and the mindset I was when I first saw both films. Seeing Skyfall came after a very long rewatch of all the Bond films. I was so into Bond nostalgia that the fact that that movie was nothing but Bond nostalgia added onto the top of a cool villain and, you know, an M story, really, like the one of the first times where the story is actually about M, and that M specifically. Mm-hmm. I was in the best possible receptive mood for that movie when it came out, if that makes any sense. When Casino Royale came out in 2006, I was 17 years old. And I was a 17-year-old guy who was very used to the style of the Pierce Brosnan films. They were my favorites. And, you know, back then I liked Die Another Day, but you have to understand Die Another Day came out when I was 14. And I saw that in the theaters. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're not the most distinguishing of moviegoers. You know what I'm saying? So the gritty, hard style of Casino Royale, while I acknowledge on the rewatch, you know, as an adult, is a great film, back then was very jarring to me. I don't know why. Maybe it was because I didn't have the attention span. Maybe it was because I wasn't used to the fact that, you know, James Bond was once again got rebooted into this uber serious mode. But mm-hmm. I did not take to it immediately the way that most people did. I acknowledge that it was a good film, but it didn't grab me at the time. Upon rewatch, it's a fantastic film, and I absolutely think it gets all the praise it deserved. But I think you like your like or dislike of a film is affected by your first viewing. And it just happened to be that I was 17 at that and not really familiar with how gritty it was going to be versus being in 2012, 23, and coming off a big Bond rewatch and being all into the nostalgia of the 50th anniversary. So. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I did love those aspects of Skyfall. Absolutely, 100%. I love those aspects of the nostalgia, the callbacks, all of that. Loved it. And also with Skyfall, the DP is Roger Deakins.
Fantastic.
Roger Deakins is mind blowing. He knows what he's doing behind a camera.
Just the way that sequence of fighting in the Shanghai building that's backlit by the neon lights and everything, I thought was gorgeous.
Here's some of what Deakins have done. This is just a sampling, okay? Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou, No Country for Old Men, The Siege, Jarhead, Revolutionary Road, Shawshank Redemption, Dead Man Walking, A Beautiful Mind, Assassination of Jesse James. That is a gorgeous movie. The Reader, Doubt. And he was a visual consultant for WALL-E, you know? And he's going to be doing the Blade Runner sequel. And this, I mean, those movies, like, when you hear those movies, you think visual style. And Skyfall definitely has a distinct visual style. I think Sam Mendes did a fantastic job directing. Probably a better job directing than Martin Campbell did. But I still think that Casino Royale is a better movie than Skyfall.
Oh, I forgot one more other thing about Skyfall that I love. And I know a lot of people rubbed up against how it was portrayed and the character itself, but I'm sorry, hands down, even though I loved what they did with her in the 90s, my favorite Moneypenny so far is Naomi Harris. By far.
She, I am really looking forward to seeing what they do with her in Spectre. And I think she's phenomenal. She's great. She's posh. Which, she's classy.
And the best thing is I didn't see the reveal coming until she takes off the coat and sits behind the desk at the end of the thing. And then I knew exactly what they were doing with her. And I think I squealed in the theater because I didn't see it coming. It completely blindsided me, and then in retrospect, it made complete sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm kind of one of those people too. Like, even though I love, like, I'm excited about her being a full blown Moneypenny in Spectre. I am excited about that. I am one of those people who walked out of the theater like, really? Like, she's, you know, she was a field agent. You know, like, they took a female field agent, they made her screw up, and then now she's a secretary. I'm just kind of like,
I know, like, people rub against that, but we don't know what she's going to do in the future.
You're right.
And the portrayal itself, just the character, whether regardless of, you know, what her status is or how she got to be relegated to being a secretary, the way she plays that character. Even though I liked what they did with her in the 90s, Moneypenny feels like an actual three-dimensional character now.
Yes, very true. She feels like an actual three-dimensional character, someone who we have a little backstory, we understand her, and maybe they expand her role. Maybe she's not just Ralph Fiennes' secretary, but she's like a project leader, like a project coordinator, you know, like, or like she is the eyes in the sky, you know, like what, like maybe she is something much more important than just someone who does Ralph Fiennes' scheduling.
So, you know, I think that by far she's my favorite Moneypenny, but Casino Royale, real briefly.
I Vesper Lind, Ava Green. I mean, she is amazing.
I gotta rewatch the movie again because she's the one. Speaking of overrated, she's the one aspect of that movie that I think is overrated.
What? Oh, bull friggin' crap. Ava Green is one of the best Bond girls out there. She is like, talk about three-dimensional. Ava Green is three-dimensional. She's fleshed out. She's human. She's real. She's saucy. She shows contempt for Bond. She doesn't just bow to his will immediately. And it just makes sense. I can see Daniel Craig and Ava Green together in this movie. And I love that she's the catalyst to make Bond Bond. I love that Daniel Craig's unrefined in this. I love that we see his first kill. I love that we see him get 00 status. That this is someone who is gruff and violent and temperamental. And then we see him slowly from this to Quantum Solace to Skyfall become the posh, calm, collected killing machine that, you know, that he ultimately is. And it all starts with Casino Royale. And I love what Martin Campbell did. I think what Martin Campbell did with GoldenEye, he did with Casino Royale. Now, GoldenEye was not, quote unquote, a reboot, but it was a revitalization. And I think Campbell is fantastic at that.
You know what both Casino Royale and Skyfall and Spectre have in common? In fact, what all these Daniel Craig films, maybe minus that Quantum of Solace, have in common is they're getting like really, really amazing A-list talent for their villains. Because in Casino Royale, you have Mads Mikkelsen, who you know I love from Hannibal.
Right.
But, you know, even before then, him as a Bond villain, it just worked. It was fantastic. And like I said, A-list level character, even though I think he was still up and coming at that point, but still, you know. Yeah. And then Javier Bardem in Skyfall.
Mind-blowing.
I mean, the fact that you get Javier Bardem at all for a Bond film is amazing. And I'm hoping, fingers crossed, the same is true for Christoph Waltz, because this guy is meant to be a Bond villain.
We've talked about it before, and we'll talk about it again. And Christoph Waltz, I believe that he was put on this earth by the Lord Almighty to be a Bond villain. I truly believe that.
I mean, just seeing the little bits of him that we've seen in the couple of trailers so far, like, I'm so looking forward to his take as a Bond villain. And if he is indeed Blofeld, I will be totally fine with that.
And also, just like one last thing, did you know? Or did you realize that Stuart Baird, the director of Star Trek Nemesis, edited Skyfall?
Oh, yeah, I was aware of that. He edited Casino Royale, too. I mean, like...
I'd forgotten that.
He is a wonderful editor. Yes. If you look at his editing credits, he's edited some of the best action films of all time.
It really is true. I mean, the guy, he edited Superman 2, Legend of Zorro, Die Hard 2, Lady Hawk, Outland, Demolition Man, Maverick... You know, like, these are all really, really fun and great movies.
If I'm not mistaken, I want to say he edited some of the Lethal Weapons, although I'm not sure.
He edited the first and the second one, and I think that's it. I think those are the only ones.
Well, the two really good ones, then.
Yeah, the two really good ones that he did. And also, he directed Executive Decision and U.S. Marshals. I love U.S. Marshals. I think it's a great movie. No BS. I love that movie.
And I'm not going to lie, it's very cheesy, but I kind of like Executive Decision.
Oh, I do too, man. Yeah, it's cheesy, but who cares? Like, you would never be able to make that movie today because it's about terrorists hijacking a plane. But everyone thought it was going to be a Steven Seagal action film, but then he dies in the first 20 minutes.
I know, he gets sucked out of the plane. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just, yeah, I think I love that movie.
I never thought I would buy or enjoy Kurt Russell as a nerd, but it kind of worked.
It works. I think it's a horribly underrated movie. But yeah, there's a lot of talent. A lot of talent went into Skyfall. Well, okay, so regardless, I think Skyfall's a great movie, but it's still number two on my list. It's Casino Royale is my number one, so...
Oh, Skyfall, Skyfall has a better song. It does.
Oh my god, yes. Oh god, Casino Royale's song was horrible.
Horrible.
Absolutely atrocious. I'm interested to see what's his name gonna be doing? Sam Smith is gonna be doing Spectre, yeah.
I could see him doing it. He's a very Adele pick. Song for Casino Royale, not so good, although it's miles better than that garbage that came with Quantum of Solace. I think that's my least favorite of all of them. God, that's awful.
You know my opinion on that.
Yes.
We're not going to talk about it.
You Jack White apologist.
I am a hardcore Jack White apologist. All right, well, that's it. We've been going for a while now. We hope you guys enjoyed it. Now, as we say at every single episode, we would absolutely love to hear from you guys, whether you email us at contact@thenerdparty.com or you make a note on our Tumblr page at thenerdparty.com. Or you can go to our Facebook page. That's probably the easiest way to make a comment, interact with other people, and talk with us. It's facebook.com/thenerdparty. Or you can talk to us on Twitter. You can find me at TheInsaneRobin.
And you can find me at mhanson0207. Thank you so much for listening to this special Bond episode of The Nerd Party. I think it's just going to be a big buildup for us here until the release of Spectre. But until that time, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you so much for listening to The Nerd Party. Well, we will always be here for your ears only.
Coming up next week.
I was hoping we could start with some insights into what you were thinking during your isolation.
Sure, yeah. Well, I can do better than that. I can tell you exactly what I was thinking. I feel like I got to some of the more important questions, and not the answers, but definitely things that just kept me up at night.
Go on.
How come Aquaman can control whales? I mean, whales are mammals. Doesn't even make sense.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.